The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Sharon Berquist, and today we have with us Dr. Jennifer Mascaro. Dr. Mascaro holds a PhD in biological anthropology from Emory University, and her doctoral work examined the impact of compassion meditation on brain function and social cognition. And she did her postdoctoral work investigating the biological basis of paternal caregiving. Currently, her research is looking at interventions that enhance social connectivity and, in doing so, how they impact our health. So, Dr. Mascaro, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. My pleasure. It's nice to be here.
So, social cognition, can you explain what that means?
Sure. So, cognition is the processes in our brain and how our brain functions to help us get around in the world. And social cognition is that branch of science devoted to trying to understand the way that our brain helps us interact with other people. So there are skills that we need to interact all the time, and there are often things that we don't even think about. We're processing signals that other people give off, emotional facial expressions, even incredibly subtle things like the shape of someone's eyes, the musculature in their face as they're talking, and their body posture. All of these things we're picking up and processing all the time. And those processes and those skills help us interact with other people and communicate and learn and copy and teach and do all the things that we need to do to function as the social organisms that we are.
Yeah, it is amazing how much of human interaction is nonverbal.
You know?
And I think the whole social cognition is what we pick up from others. And a lot of times you almost know intuitively how you feel about somebody before you can explain it logically, which is really a fascinating thing.
Right, right. And so a lot of that stuff goes on below the level of consciousness. And of course, there is a lot that's verbal too, but all the time we're copying one another's body postures and we're noticing others doing the same and all of these things that are really below the level of consciousness. And so the field of social cognition sort of tries to study those processes and how they unfold in our brain and the variability in humans and what makes us vary in those skills. You know, why are some people so good at those things and some people struggle with those?
Yeah, you know, I think the closest term that is used for this is really emotional intelligence, right? So some people seem to be really good at reading people, reading situations. So how much variability is there just naturally among humans?
There's a lot of variability. And so the field of emotional intelligence and that term it was important because it pointed to the idea that there's more than just the intelligence that we often think of. Emotional intelligence is, you know, the ability to understand our own emotions and be aware of our own emotions and then those emotions of others. And it's clear that there's a lot of variability. There's a development of those skills across the lifespan, and then there's a lot of variability across humans and across cultures. Even in a single individual, there is variability in terms of the contexts that we're in. So, these processes sort of ebb and flow even in a single individual, depending on the context that they're in.
That's so interesting. So how much is genetic? How much is learned through culture and social environments?
Right. That's always the
million-dollar question,
exactly.
Right?
Those nature-nurture questions are difficult to get a handle on. But it's clear that there is a genetic component, a heavy genetic component to those sorts of factors, things like empathy and perspective-taking ability. Those have a heritable component. It's clear that the way parents interact with their children has an impact quite early, and it's clear that there are all kinds of environmental factors that that play a role too. So it's one of those typical sort of quintessential nature nurture messy sort of phenomena.
Yeah, it's never black and white.
Right, definitely not.
Yeah, and You know, I think a lot of people want to improve their emotional intelligence. It's just a good skill in life to be able to read a situation. And a lot of workplaces are actually interviewing and hiring more based on emotional intelligence than I think objective measures of intelligence. So what are ways people can improve their emotional intelligence?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the coolest lines of research, I think, that's come out of late is just believing that it's a growth process, just the recognition that you can get better is profoundly impactful. So there are some really cool studies that show that people who believe that they can become more empathic are actually more apt to do so. So just believing in sort of a growth mindset and sort of becoming aware that these are things that we can get better at, just that in and of itself is really impactful. I think that's a really cool thing. And then, you know, the research suggests that there are all kinds of experiences that alter the way we connect with others. So interacting with lots of diverse types of people is impactful, especially for children. Experiencing awe, you know, experiencing things that sort of take your breath away is really impactful for sort of jolting you into the realization that there are others around you. So engaging in experiences that give you a sense of awe, you know, going out and looking at the stars, experiencing a monument or a museum, you know, things that connect you through time and space to other people. Those are things that research has shown help us have more empathy for others, help us sort of connect with others.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. You know, I know you do a lot of work with social connectivity and on compassion, and it's really interesting that those are the traits that improve emotional intelligence because, you know, culturally we're inundated with what are the traits, for example, as a parent, like what do you encourage in your child, right? So, you know, if I play devil's advocate to what you just said, there's a big cultural push to teach your kids to defend for themselves, dog eat dog world, get out there and you know, and do, as opposed to compassion. You know, so what's the science behind the link really between compassion and social cognition or emotional intelligence?
Right. So this idea, this field of emotional intelligence has gotten a lot more recognition of late with, you know, big companies talking about how in their hiring process they're realizing how important these skills are and how predictive these skills are for people's success in life and in employment. And it's interesting, so there's been some really interesting research where most parents, if you interview them, will say that they encourage their children to be compassionate. But when you look at the way we sort of grade children, right, like when the rubber meets the road, kids don't get grades for compassion, and kids pick up on that. They know what gets them the A in school is not necessarily compassion. And so as much as we often encourage our kids to be compassionate, it's difficult when our society is set up to often encourage other things, and kids pick up on that.
Yeah. You know, what I love about your work is that, you know, you have a background in anthropology, and anthropology really helps us understand why we are the way we are as human beings. And sometimes that is so different from what we encourage as a culture. So what may be best for us as human beings may not be what we perceive to be best from media and TV, et cetera. How does compassion work on kind of a biologic level to improve our emotional intelligence?
Yeah, so often it's important to define a term, because especially a term like compassion, because we use it so freely. And so when scientists talk about compassion, they often mean the ability to see when and sense when someone is suffering, and then the motivation to help them. So that motivation component is really important for compassion. It's not just taking on the suffering of the people around you, but it's this sort of aspiration or this sort of motivation or almost like an itch to help someone when you see them suffering. And it's important to note, too, that compassion doesn't always look like one thing. You know, there is fierce compassion and compassion often in the realm of parenting, where you have to do what's best for your child, even if it doesn't look like lovey-dovey nurturing kind of stuff. And compassion is often more complex than we think. But the idea is that it evolved because we are mammals, and we relied on caring for young offspring who were completely helpless. And humans, we have offspring who are completely helpless for long periods of time. So it was really important for us to evolve a way to nurture offspring, especially when they're suffering, when they're crying out and need help. So we have these systems in our brain and our body that help us respond kind of proactively to suffering. We don't, we don't run from it. We don't try to get away from suffering, which is quite amazing when you start to think about it. We actually move towards suffering, and that's what compassion is. And that's how it's been important for our species and for mammals in general to take care of their offspring.
And that is so fascinating. You know, when you say that it's the motivation to want to help, it's really altruism.
Right.
Or there is a large component of altruism involved in compassion.
Right. Often it's you're helping at a cost to yourself. That's what the way we often define altruism. It's helping someone or a group even at cost to yourself, even if it is expensive in some way to your own well-being. And so compassion often is doing that. It's sort of a drive to nurture, even if it is at cost to your own well-being. And I should clarify, though, well-being, immediate well-being. So often there's a benefit to well-being in the long run.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was just about to go there with you because I know you do so much research on the health impact of compassion. And like you said, in the short term, sure, it's at a cost, you know, because it takes time away from other things that we could be doing. What are the health implications of compassion?
So it's clear that there are profound health implications for deep social connection. So when people have rich, deep social connections that they find meaningful, there is a benefit to our health and well-being that's along the lines of all the other health behaviors that we know are really important. So we know that having those connections is important. And then it's clear that the systems in our brain and body that foster those types of connections, you know, that help us respond with compassion, those are systems in the brain that and in the body that are really good for our health outcomes. So we know that when we're responding compassionately, we have the reward systems in our brain respond and our body responds in ways that really are optimal for our health.
Yeah, you know, what you're saying reminds me of the movie with Tom Hanks, Castaway. I'm not sure if you saw that movie, but to our listeners, if you haven't, so Tom Hanks is, you know, stranded on this island with no human interaction, and this volleyball from one of the FedEx packages he calls Wilson, and that was his only form of socialization for the entire time he was a castaway. And it's so profound, that need for human interaction, where even a volleyball, you know, serves that purpose. I mean, we are really social creatures, and that connectivity is how we are biologically wired for health. There's a lot of research in the role of compassion in its effect on stress. Mm-hmm. And on the immune system. And I know you do work in that area. What have you seen?
Right. So what it looks like is, we as these evolved mammals, we're really relying on the immune systems that are in place and that have been around for many, many millions of years. And some of the most amazing research is that which shows when you feel isolated and lonely, it is a threatening state, you know, and throughout human history, that's a threatening state. So Tom Hanks in Castaway, you know, that was a dangerous, threatening state to be all by himself. And our immune system has evolved to respond to that threatening state in a way as though the body's under siege. So when someone feels lonely and isolated, their inflammatory system sort of ramps up. It needed to throughout human history, because often when you were alone and isolated, that meant you were in danger and your immune system needed to be ready to respond. So from a long game perspective, a human evolutionary history perspective, having that immune response to isolation might have helped keep us alive. But in the sort of short-term immediate perspective of my own life and our own lives, it's not. It means that it is not optimal for our health to feel lonely. When we feel lonely, our body is responding that way. When we feel isolated or ostracized in the world, our inflammation system sort of ramps up. And so that's what we see. The research shows that when people report feeling lonely or having less than ideal social connections, or when you monitor the number of connections that people have throughout their day, and people who have fewer, you can see that their immune system and their, especially their inflammatory immune system, is hyperreactive. And that seems to be a link between loneliness and all sorts of chronic disease states, like, you know, that lead to heart disease and cancer.
Correct. And diabetes.
All of those things, you know, you can sort of trace the lines where feeling under threat, feeling under siege, leads to these changes in our body that ultimately you can start to understand chronic disease.
And, you know, we live in a time where stress and anxiety are almost an epidemic. You know, I know in the office I see so many people. In fact, there are national estimates that about, you know, 80%+ of visits to primary care are stress-related, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's a stress-related illness or stress itself that brings someone to the doctor's office. And stress-related illness meaning, you know, headaches, stomach aches, all the ways that stress can manifest itself. And is that trend correlating, you know, with isolation across the country? You know, are we spending less time with family, friends, nurturing relationships? And is that part of what's leading us to really these stress anxiety trends?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about that, especially of late, you know, even around the world. In the UK, they appointed a minister of loneliness recently with this recognition and some really staggering statistics, especially in elderly populations where they have a large segment of the elderly population who, you know, they quantified had gone many, many days without seeing another human being. And so then the question arose, is something that's gotten worse throughout time? And that's a little bit thorny. It's a little bit difficult to know what the trend is over time. Are we just better at talking about and recognizing these things than we used to be? Or is it something that has really gotten worse? I think that it's not completely clear yet. I think it is good that we're starting to recognize what a big problem it is, so that we can start to try to understand the causes. You know, is it that we are, you know, much more fragmented and isolated than we used to be based on, you know, the way our society is structured? And if so, what can we do about that?
Right. So, and then, you know, tying all these pieces together, compassion, empathy, reduce stress, improve immune function, make a person healthier. They also promote emotional intelligence and how we interact with other people. And really, it's the best way to stay healthy, help yourself, is by helping others.
Right. So that's one of the amazing things. And it's not something that would be immediately obvious, but it comes from some of our ancient wisdom that has told us, you know, we hear that's the pathway to happiness and well-being. And it's evident in the science too. So there are amazing studies that track people's language, and you can predict, not completely, but you can start to see a correlation between even the amount of I language versus we language and future heart disease, heart attacks. People who use more we language are less likely to have a heart attack. And the idea there is that, exactly as you say, people who start to sort of get out of their own head and start to look toward others are, it's helping their immune system, it's helping in the immediate with their stress physiology, and then you can see these long-term consequences.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that what helps emotional intelligence really is what helps you biologically, but also if you are building these traits of compassion and you become more emotionally intelligent, it's amazing how that propels success, right? So we're somehow, as humans, somewhere deep down inside, despite what culture is saying, we recognize why we may not even know, but why we like people, why we want to follow them, why we want them as leaders. And it comes down to this element of social cognition that's happening, you know, at many different levels, as you mentioned, but, you know, compassion being one of them. And it's so interesting that we're drawn to it. We like it when we see it in others, but sometimes culturally we deviate from following that pattern.
Right, right. So I think that's where the science is really important, because when people actually do the research on sort of what makes an effective leader and what makes for a productive environment in a workplace, it's very clear that it's those traits like, the emotional intelligence and the sort of compassionate behavior towards coworkers. Those are the things that seem to impact, you know, in across employment domains. And so it is strange. And I think it's that tide is turning. I think people are really starting to it's becoming a popular notion that, and the science is sort of infusing out into the public domain that, it really does make a difference to be around kind people, and it works better, you know, at all different levels, and so my hope is that's changing, that sort of stereotype of the sort of top-down authoritarian, you know, sort of employment and workplace environment. I think it's becoming clear that isn't an effective model.
Yeah, and certainly not for health.
Not for health.
Yeah. In terms of adopting compassion, you know, you said, you know, changing I to we, okay, that I think people can teach themselves to do, but how can you teach yourself to be more compassionate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so that's one of the things that we're working on. So, you know, you start to see the science and you start to really appreciate how impactful it is to have these rich connections and to feel compassion towards others. And so what do you do about that? So one of the ways that we've approached it is, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. There are traditions and ideas out there about training compassion, and that these are traits and skills that actually can be trained almost like a muscle in the gym.
You're referring to Eastern cultures?
Often. And yeah. Not only, though. But that's the one of the things that we've looked at is an old Tibetan Buddhist tradition. It's called the Lojong tradition. It comes from an 11th century tradition that really is an analytical argument, a logic-based training for how to train up compassion. So here at Emory, we have, in the religion department, they have taken that tradition and that practice and sort of adapted it for modern secular cultures. And we're looking at whether this training program, we call it cognitively based compassion training. We look at whether training people in this tradition, in this program, actually trains up their compassion. Does it help them be more compassionate towards others? Does it help enrich their social connections? And then when that happens, does it impact their health?
What are the elements of the program? Like for somebody who's not enrolled in the program but is just listening to the podcast, what are ways that maybe at home are there practices that you could be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So we think some of the key elements. So the first thing that the program does is it trains people to be still with their own emotions. So it begins with some mindfulness. You often hear about mindfulness practices. It's a sort of a stillness and an attention practice that helps sort of cultivate noticing our own emotions. So it begins with just mindfulness to the breath, noticing the breath as it comes in and out of the nose, not the nostrils, sort of sitting with that feeling and starting to notice the sensations in our body that we often just ignore when we're so busy and rushed. So it starts with a sort of a foundation in attention and stillness. But the other things that we think are core about training compassion, it trains us to think about our sort of fundamental humanity and the fundamental humanity around us, sort of the common aspirations that we all have, that all people sort of desire to be kind of happy and free from suffering, right? It's sort of noticing that in our lives and how that really is true. And then noticing our interconnections, noticing that everything we do depends on everyone else. Even the smallest, most simple thing, like the shirt that you're wearing, starting to think about the many, many lives that that shirt has touched and all the different things that had to come into place just for the shirt that we're wearing to be there for us. And so something as simple as a shirt, you can start to think about all the different parts of our lives that, where we rely on so many other people throughout history and throughout time and place. And so we think that these are sort of fundamental things. So a sort of still mindfulness that allows us to pay attention to our body and our place and our emotions, sort of noticing our common humanity, and then noticing our interconnections. And then what we think is that when you start to do that, compassion naturally emerges. When you start to see everyone around us as this common humans along with us, you can't help but feel more compassionate for others. When you start to notice our interconnections, you can't help but feel it just naturally emerges. So that's sort of the idea behind the program, and those are some of the things I think that even if you don't go through a training program, you can start to notice those things in your life and in our lives as we go about our daily lives.
And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, with your line of work, you must be very attentive to your own emotions and how they influence your interactions. What are things that you've observed?
Yeah. Not as in touch with my emotions as I would like. But the fun thing about the science that I do is it's a constant reminder. And so sometimes I do notice that some of the things that I study happen, you know, play out in my life in really interesting ways, you know, that I wouldn't have noticed otherwise. So one of the things that I think is really amazing is that one of the key things that gets in our way of compassion quite often is the thing that gets in our way of sort of feeling compassion is feeling like we are not allowed to, or we can't, or we're not able to be compassionate. And what I mean by that is, you know, the feeling of compassion often that motivation or that the desire to help someone, often it rests on the sort of the confidence to know that you actually can help, or the knowledge that there's a way that you can help. So one of the things that I find interesting is I start to notice that in my life, where if I think of a way that I can actually help someone, that I notice that the compassion sort of emerges naturally from that. In ways, in times where you're not able to help, or you don't feel confident, where I feel helpless, I notice that I'm not as able to generate those feelings, and I start to see that play out. That's what the science tells us, and I start to see that in my daily life in interesting ways.
You know, and it's really interesting you say that. I see that when I have, you know, I work with anyone who's grieving, and how many times the person who's grieving will tell me that people didn't come up to them to say anything about their loved one. And so much of that is from the awkwardness, I think, of people around the topic of death and not feeling that they know what to say to the person who's just lost a loved one. So they don't say anything, or they completely start talking about the weather or something totally
right.
unrelated to dance around.
Because they feel uncomfortable.
The grieving in the
yeah.
morning. Yet to the person who's going through the grieving process, it is just so disheartening that this person isn't acknowledging that their loved one is gone. And to your point, it's that not feeling confident about knowing what to say around difficult topics.
Right.
And having that confidence of connecting with a person that way, which, you know, really doesn't take much other than acknowledgement, but yet it's such an awkward
It's a perfect example.
Yeah.
It's a perfect example. Just sort of having the confidence to know, even if I don't know what to say, just my being here is enough, and I'm going to do the best I can. Even if I say something awkward, it's, you know, I can do something by being here and trying. So, I think that's a great example of how a little kernel of confidence goes a long way towards helping us be compassionate towards others in the face of immense suffering.
Yeah, it also really brings up the gender difference. Like, do we raise boys differently than girls? You know, with girls, I think we do encourage compassion, nurturing, and their feminine traits, so most women don't mind adopting them. With boys and men, I don't think we encourage compassion because they are defenders, and we expect a different level of traits. Yet our biology is the same, right? So what implication does that have?
Right, yeah. So there's That's a huge debate, of course, that a popular debate, but also a scientific debate. You know, when you observe, when scientists observe differences between men and women, is that because of biological differences that are that are there sort of from the beginning, or is that because is that because of a lifetime of socialization? It's very clear that people talk to little boys differently than they talk to little girls, and that happens very early. People tend to attend to emotions more in girls than they do in boys. People tend to validate emotions in girls more than they do in boys. And people encourage compassion and empathy more in girls than they tend to do in boys. Now, this is not, of course, not across the board. These are just sort of trends that we see. And so it's extremely difficult to really understand, are there really any differences between men and women in terms of the ability to be compassionate and empathic? Can you get around that lifetime of socialization and gender socialization that occurs? It's hard to know.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you think of, like we just talked about, the health implications of that, the stress management that comes with having that compassion, the emotional intelligence, and all these traits. And you know, should we as a culture define masculinity through compassion?
Right. So there's a lot of discussions about that. And in the world of sort of thinking about compassion, there's a lot of discussion, as I alluded to earlier, about, you know, compassion always doesn't always look like this very, lovey-dovey sort of thing. Often compassion is quite fierce and requires confidence and strength and putting yourself out there. And so when we start to think about what compassion really is, and you start to think about the attributes that go along with compassion, it is certainly not at odds with the ideas of masculinity that we often uphold as, you know, the pinnacles of masculinity. There's a strength and a fierceness that's required for compassionate that is certainly compatible with masculinity. It does a disservice to men to imagine that they can't show those attributes and those sort of traits.
Yeah. What are examples of the fierceness?
So I think about it often in healthcare and in what you do. And my husband's a clinical psychologist. And so there is a sort of fierce compassion that goes along with trying to help people who are suffering that I think is really important when trying to help people who, you know, they need a change in their life in order to be healthy and to achieve well-being. Change is difficult. Yeah. And there's a fierceness that goes along with clinical compassion, I think. And I think about that a lot. It's one of the reasons that I think the work that I do, we end up a lot working in healthcare and trying to understand physicians and physician burnout and compassion fatigue. Yeah. So that's what comes to mind first with me is the sort of fierce compassion that goes along with trying to help people change behavior. The other domain is, as I said earlier, with parenting. Parenting often involves a sort of pay me now or pay me later decision making. That's one of the pet phrases in my house. Often there are difficult, fierce, compassionate acts that parents need to display toward their children for their children's best interest, or it's going to be worse later. So there's a fierce compassion that comes into parenting, I think,
great,
as well.
Great example. I can relate to that.
I bet. I think any parent can.
Yeah, so before we wrap up, and you know, again, I think the work that you do is just phenomenal, and thank you for sharing that with us. Are there any parting words or advice you want to suggest or recommend to our audience?
Yeah, I think one of the things that strikes me clearly is our social connections are as important for our health as anything else. So it's important to take those seriously as we would take, you know, diet and exercise and, stopping smoking, all those things that are really clearly going to impact our longevity and also our well-being. Social connections are right up there with those things. So taking them seriously is important. But understanding and appreciating that we are organisms that can grow and we can actually get better at those skills, I think is a remarkable idea. It's remarkable to me. I see it in my own life that just the recognition that we can get better. You know, we might not say the right thing one time when a person is suffering, and we can learn from that and do better the next time. And so the growth process and the ability to get better at those skills, I think, is a wonderful recognition and empowering. It means that if you don't feel like you have a lot of emotional intelligence, you can get better at those things. They're like muscles that we exercise in the gym.
That's fascinating. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has just been a great conversation.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. It was really fun.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.